This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. It's Wednesday, so it's The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable, and we've got a lot of news to talk about this week. So let me bring in our guests. Of course, as always, Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Hello again, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
Jackie Rabe Thomas is here. Jacqueline is the education reporter for the Connecticut Mirror. Good to see you, Jackie.
Good to see you.
Dan Haar is here. He's columnist for The Hartford Current. Hello again, Dan.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm pretty good. And Keith Faniff, who is our budget guru from the Connecticut Mirror. Hi there, Keith.
Good morning.
So we're going to be talking about a lot of things, but we're going to be starting with Governor Daniel Malloy's State of the State address last week and his appearance earlier this week on Where We Live. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. You can email us wherewelive@wnpr.org, or you can tweet us at Where We Live. What did you hear in the governor's speech that you liked? What are some things you have some questions about? Colin, just off the top, give me your broad impressions about Governor Malloy, what he rolled out last week, and how he talked about some of these things on the show earlier this week.
Well, we talked, I think, last week about how we should have some sort of audio graphic that sort of, you know, how you know this is an election year. Well, this is how you know it's an election year. I mean, obviously, you know it's an election year because some of the numbers, in ways which Keith is going to be able to help us understand, have been repositioned a little bit so that – remember how bad things were 4 years ago? Well, I mean, things have improved, but I mean also the numbers are repositioned because in an election year, things are made to look absolutely as good as possible. I mean, the other thing that you hear a little bit in Malloy's budget address is an attempt to – reposition himself a little bit. I mean, the whole kind of I'm not perfect, which would not be a damaging admission for most people, but for Dan Malloy, it does represent, you know, a step in a certain direction. It's not necessarily a psychological or emotional tone he's able to maintain over long periods of time. We heard him on your show the other day, and some guy from Ledyard called up and with a fairly respectful and innocent question about whether some of the savings at the state level would hurt the municipalities in terms of ECL funding or other kinds of municipal funding, and his reaction was, "You're joking, right?" It's kind of like, well, that's not really how you usually say thank you for your question, something like that. But anyway, he tried in his speech anyway to position himself a little bit differently. But I mean, I think most people would agree, the big news is they are presenting the numbers in a way that illustrates a certain kind of progress, which may or may not be illusory.
Well, and I'm going to turn to Keith Faniff and Dan Haar, who both have been writing about some of the budget numbers, the ideas that the governor has rolled out, and some of the things he talked about on our show. And again, if you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Also, whenever anybody says anything today, I'm just going to start by saying, "You're kidding, right?"
Yeah.
I've learned that now. I think that's the appropriate way to do things. So, Keith, you listened very closely to our show the other day, and you've been following the budget as closely as anybody else. When Governor Malloy talks about, and he did talk a bit on the show, about wiping out $11 billion in debt over the first couple years of his term, wiping out an awful lot of a $3.6 billion deficit that he was handed by Jody Rell, what parts of that is he exactly right about? What parts of it is he sort of not telling us the whole truth about?
And that's the thing, the whole truth. Now, I want to use one of my favorite lines, which is let's take a look at that. Let's take a closer look at that. When he talked about, for example, cutting back our debt by $11 billion, it's true he's talking about the obligations we owe for retirement health care benefits for state workers. Well, a big part of that $11 billion is a very painful step we haven't taken yet. We don't take that step until 2018. The workers have to set aside 3% of their salaries toward their retiree health care. We have to start matching it in 2018. That's kind of like if I'm smoking a cigarette right now going, you know, that's it. I'm going to quit. I can't believe I didn't do this earlier. You know, sorry, nobody can see the sight gag. I'm pretending to drag on a cigarette. And I'm basically saying, you know, I don't even miss it. That's because you haven't taken the painful step yet. He's committed us down the road to take painful steps that will help save $11 billion. But we haven't taken all those steps yet, which is why it seems like, wow, how did that $11 billion savings pop up?
And this $11 billion number, it's not one that we've heard an awful lot about. But again, he's going to start talking about it because it is a fairly large number. We'll get into some of the details in just a moment. Let's hear a little bit about some of the things that Governor Malloy talked about. One of the things that he touted during his election campaign was the idea that he was going to move us toward generally accepted accounting principles, otherwise known as GAAP. Here's a little bit about the governor talking about GAAP.
The first thing I did as governor is put generally accepted accounting principles into place. And no one can point to our reporting as not being compliant with generally accepted accounting principles, period. That's the end of that story, quite frankly.
So Keith, is that the end of that story, quite frankly?
I'm sorry. I can point to a time when the Malloy administration was not following generally accepted accounting principles. The first 2 years of the Malloy administration did not follow generally accepted accounting principles. The governor's first budget that he signed – and by the way, there's not a lot of detail to this. There's two things you have to do. One, you have to keep the books in compliance with GAAP. We postpone that obligation until year three of his term, right in the first budget he signed for people who want to look it up. The other thing you have to do is you begin to have to start saving the money or finding some other way to collect the money you need that we should have had we been following GAAP principles, putting the money in a jar, so to speak. We didn't start that process till year three, and the first chunk of money we set aside, we borrowed. He remembers his talking points from the campaign when he promised from day one we'd start reporting and we'd start saving. All we did on day one is he signed an executive order ordering his budget director to study the issue. But the problem is he remembers the talking points well. The details don't always match up with them.
But we're there now, Dan Haar. We seem to be using GAAP accounting there.
I think we're getting we're in something called partial GAAP accounting, and there's another step that has to be taken.
Which
we don't want to talk about. But the major issue with GAAP is, in simple terms, is that instead of paying bills when they – instead of accounting for liabilities, that is things the state has to pay for, when you pay them, you account for them when you accrue the debt. Right? So it's like a credit card. And as soon as you run up the bill, that's how much less you have in your bank account. And essentially it amounts to, in rough terms, 30 days of the state. And so it's just finding that money. And we borrowed the money. And so the bigger issue now is not whether we are or are not following GAAP accounting rules. It's why and whether we should have borrowed the money to do so. That was the 700. Correct me if I'm wrong, Keith. Is that
560. Plus we borrowed the interest on our GAAP borrowing, so we didn't have to make payments till after the election.
So the issue with borrowing is how then did we borrow money? How then are we calling what we have now a surplus if we borrowed money? And I think that's a false accusation.
Well, okay. So we talked a lot with the governor about this idea of borrowing money. He speaks very clearly about what his predecessors did, and the reason why he ended up with a $3.6 billion deficit is because a lot of these same things happened in the Roland and Rell administration. All sorts of debts were being pushed forward to the next administration. That's what he has to deal with. When I ask him about borrowing, when I ask him about things like taking money out of the transportation fund, here's what he had to say.
There were gigantic raids on the transportation front. Did we end all of that at once? The answer is no. Will we end it by next year? The answer is yes. Am I 100% pure? Well, I have pure in my intentions because we're getting to that target after years of, quite frankly, raiding that fund.
But you have taken money from the transportation fund.
On a declining basis to zero next year.
That's Governor Daniel Malloy speaking with me. Colin, this idea of having good intentions and moving toward this plan in a year after an election year is something that we were hearing from the governor, you know, a lot the other day. Keith is making the point that, you know, this isn't the same as, you know, changing all the rules day one of your administration. How do you hear this, especially again in an election year?
Yeah, I mean, it's very hard to disagree with Keith about this. That it's unimpressive. In the third year of your term, the year in which you're about to be evaluated by voters again, to start doing the thing that you subscribed to or said you subscribed to initially. So yes, he was very critical of his predecessors for raiding this gas tax money, basically, that's supposed to go for transportation improvements. And so now he's going to stop doing it. As Keith suggested before, he's been cutting down on doing it a little bit, but now he's going to finally stop doing it. I mean, I don't know how much this means to voters or to average citizens. I think voters and average citizens notice whether their taxes go up or not. I think that's about it, probably. The conversation we're having right now is probably going to fall on mostly deaf ears. But
if it's a conversation that's going to fall on mostly deaf ears, it seems as though the administration is working awful hard to make sure that they're sending out a certain message. It must mean something to somebody. Something I know we've talked about in the past, Keith, is this idea that if you want to give the governor credit for something, it's that in real terms, he had this enormous deficit. And I talked to him about this the other day. $3.6 billion put forward by two successive Republican administrations. He's closed that in real numbers by some maybe $2.6 billion. We're still going to have a big budget deficit in the next year, but he's done a really good job in cutting down the state's debts.
No, I totally agree. I think I'm maybe one of the few reporters who says he probably didn't talk enough about the problems he inherited. I think it goes back to what Colin said, which is he's just trying in an election year to frame things as glowingly as possible, except when you find things like the transportation fund. And just before that clip you played, you had pressed him and said, well, Governor, you've done these things. When you press him, then he says, well, you should grade me on the curve. Yes, I'm not pure, but I'm pure in my intentions, and that's what counts. That's to me, the recurring theme is that his message is very extreme, and then they almost seem to take offense when you fact-check them on it.
So, Dan Haar, as you look at the totality of the governor's budget plan that he's rolled out here, again, in this election year, I mean, what do you see? Do you see something in which he can rightfully say, look, I inherited such a big problem that I really can talk for some time now about what Jody Rell and John Rowland did? Or are you seeing something different moving forward here? Can he continue to make these claims that this problem that the state seems to be in is on somebody else's watch?
Yes and no. He can make the claims that they're on somebody else's watch. The fact is that what he did has to be evaluated after now 3 years into the fourth year on its own. And I don't think – I think it's a specious argument to say we shouldn't have borrowed this money, for example, to pay for operations because we already – he had the $1.5 billion budget tax increase. He's cut 1,200 jobs from the general fund portion of the – overall, it's about 1,200 jobs. Which is pretty good. If that pace keeps up, that's a lot of sort of modernization, if you will. And so there's not much else you can do. And so to me, the issue is not even whether the previous administration was at fault or not. It's what were the alternatives starting in January of 2011, and did he do what he did, what was best? And he says yes, and the voters will decide. I don't see – I see the problem, as Keith said, of being a matter of speaking precisely. When he says things – when he says we've cut the debt – he means we've cut the liability, and he's glossing over the fact that we've increased the debt and cut the liability. Words matter.
One of the other things that he's talking about here, though, is he is assuming better economic recovery than the Office of the OFA. I forget what it's called, the Office of
Fiscal Analysis.
OFA, that's right.
So what do we take out of that? I mean, you follow very closely whether or not our economy is recovering. Dan, I mean, do we have a recovery that's going to support the sort of numbers, whether it's job and employment numbers or whether it's just an improving economy that Governor Dan Malloy seems to suggest will happen to get the numbers to where he wants them?
To what he said was a balanced budget in 2015? The short answer is no, and the long answer is no, because the underlying assumptions in the economic model are 2% growth in employment, which we haven't seen, I believe, in at least 10 years, possibly since the 90s, and 8% growth in income, which we also haven't seen since that time. It's not going to happen.
Oh, I mean, that's been the recurring criticism of economists again and again and again, is that it's not that the revenues aren't growing or the economy's that improving, is that our assumptions continue to be inflated. So people, when they keep hearing, oh, revenue forecasts are down. No, they're just down from the high expectations we set. There is improvement, but like Dan says, we've been setting standards that we haven't met in a long time.
Let's talk about quickly before we take a break. One more thing having to do with his proposals. We have right now a $500 million surplus, as Keith points out. This is a real surplus in the sense of this is what we have moving forward. There is a big budget deficit in the next few years already looming, Colin. But when the governor gives his State of the State address, he says, we're going to put some of the rainy day fund. I think everyone thinks that's probably a pretty smart idea. We're going to pay down some of the debt. That's a pretty smart idea. And then he's going to give back $55 to each individual citizen of the state of Connecticut because we helped to do this all together and we need to all share in this. We've seen this before. Governor Rowland did this in an election year. I mean, does it matter to give back $55 to people?
I can't imagine that it does. I mean, it's a tank of gas, basically. I think we talked about this last week. I think a larger question, I mean, one thing, some sunny day that will never happen, it would be wonderful to know how much state government actually costs and how much we have to pay for it, which is the sort of the two things we are really never told.
Now you're talking crazy talk.
Yeah. And so inevitably we're having these conversations about gimmicks, you know, and the shifting around of money. And the thing that I think is interesting, one thing we should quickly say before we conclude is this conversation is so far from being over. Now it will be taken over by the state legislature, a group of people who are also not opposed to appearing to balance budgets through gimmickry. So I don't think we've seen the last of the gimmicks, although interestingly, Beth Bayh, one of the few legislators I would trust with anything, is taking over as a Probst chairman. I don't know if she'll bring any new note of sanity to all of this. But this conversation and these kinds of machinations that only Keith Faniff understands are far from over.
We're talking with Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Keith Faniff is the budget reporter for the Connecticut Mirror, and Dan Haar is a columnist for the Hartford Current. When we come back, we're going to be talking about some of the things that Governor Malloy hopes to do around education, investing in the state college system, universal pre-K, perhaps, and also more talk about the teachers' unions in the state with Jacqueline Rabe Thomas from the Connecticut Mirror. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. This is where we live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. It's Wednesday, so it's The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. And we're talking with you at 860-275-7266 about the news of the week. But right now we're talking with Jacqueline Rabe Thomas, education reporter for the Connecticut Mirror. As we look through all of the budget proposals that the governor put out in his State of the State, there's an awful lot that had to do with education. Let's start, you know, with the young kids, Jackie. Universal pre-K, he talked very openly about wanting to get there. It's something we've been asking about for a while. How's he going to get to universal pre-K and when?
So the governor is proposing that by in the next 5 years that there be universal access to pre-K. So there's a difference between universal pre-K and universal access. So what he is proposing is that every child whose family cannot afford to go to pre-K be provided the opportunity to do so, that money not hinder that opportunity. And it starts off in the state's lowest performing districts, which are typically your Bridgeport, your New Haven, those districts, and then ramping it up in the other alliance districts, which are your other 30 lowest performing districts.
But how do you determine who can afford it and who can't? It's sort of like the healthcare debate. I mean, if you have insurance already, you don't have to worry about it. If you don't have insurance, you get into this pool. Is it sort of like that, providing a safety net for people who don't have it right now?
Right. It's based on your income, and there are standards in an existing program called School Readiness Program that many, many children already participate in. And it would be based off of those standards from what I've read so far, from what he's proposed. And what it would do is use those standards to qualify. Now, the School Readiness Programs are diverse schools. It's not just low-income students that are participating in those schools. So it's a hybrid of different populations in these programs.
And how does this get paid for over the course of the next 5 years?
That is a good question. There's no money that's taken out of the Office of Early Education's budget for this, so it would be somewhere else in the budget.
Okay, so universal pre-K is something, it's an aspiration that we hope to go to. Another one that seems as though it's a little bit more tangible right now is this bigger investment in this state university system. This is a system that used to be somewhat fragmented and disparate that the governor has put together under this Board of Regents. It's the state colleges, the four, and then also all of the community colleges. He said on our program, you know, UConn's gotten a lot of press. UConn's gotten a lot of money. Now we want to invest in this CSUS system or whatever it's called now. What's he going to do?
So just to put in context, the fiscal situation of the colleges throughout the state, UConn included, the state has really cut a lot of their state support that they've sent since 2011. So, for example, looking at the community college system and the Board of Regents system, they have been cut since 2011 by about $45 million. So this proposal for $60 million in additional funding for them this coming fiscal year would really just bring them above where they were at pre-massive deficit that the governor
sort
had
of
to
getting
deal
their
with.
Head above water. Yeah.
Right, exactly. But with that said, there's a lot of upcoming costs that the college system has to pay for. For example, there are a lot of people switching over to a new retirement plan courtesy of the concessions agreement. And the onus of who pays for that is on the college system. and the state gets to reap, gets to keep the savings from that switchover because it actually is cheaper for the state when people switch over to that retirement system. And then there's also a lot of costs associated with incoming students. And they, what they've done for that has been to make sure that it has been to cut some course availability, increase class sizes. So the fiscal situation at the Board of Regents system has not been pretty as displayed during several of their meetings recently.
So essentially what the governor's proposing is just trying to get them back to a place where, as I said before, getting their head back above water because the system has been starved for some time, and there have been a lot of complaints about it. One thing very quickly, Colin, I asked him about, you know, we'd been reading stories about Tennessee's Republican governor wanting to pay for the first 2 years of school at say, community colleges for everybody who wants to go. It sounds to me like that's the sort of ambitious plan that other states are undertaking. Here we're, you know, we're reinvesting in a system that is kind of brand new, might take a while to actually work. Do you see that investment in this state university system in the way that the governor is talking about is something that is going to make sense long term?
Well, there's two things. The two things that you just talked about are tied to one another. They both universal pre-K and repairing the community college and state university system both have to do with disparity, really. And so it's a crime what's happened in each case. Universal pre-K is something that everybody has known about for decades and decades, that there aren't any magic bullets in the world of education reform. But if there is one, it's universal pre-K. Every board that ever studied this question has said that obviously poverty is the driving force in educational disparity. But if there's one thing you could do, it's universal pre-K. The fact that we don't have this nationwide right now is a social crime. So the fact that we're still talking about how we're going to try to do something like this over the next 5 years is also appalling. And similarly, the community colleges and also the state university system, these are the stepping stones out of poverty. These are the gates that open and let people into the American system. It's incredibly important to fund them. And yeah, UConn has been the darling child of this system. It's a very well-wired network. Their board has a lot more access to the people in power. And so now these other systems are playing catch up. But it's really important that they get funded.
One of the things that the governor talked about is this new college savings program. He says, look, this isn't going to send anybody to school, but it's going to put money aside for children born in Connecticut to try to incentivize good behavior, saving for colleges. How does this get paid for, Jackie?
So the $12 million for that program is from one-time funding from a now-defunct college loan program that will be used for it. And in an effort to keep that sustainable after that $12 million runs out, the plan is to ask taxpayers when they file their annual taxes to check off the box for a donation, just as you would for like Make-A-Wish Foundation or other different initiatives.
Dan Hart, when we talk about investing in education, this is something we talk about all the time. We want to grow jobs here. We want to grow an economy. Are the sorts of investments in education, whether it's early childhood or in the CSU system, are these the sort of investments that the state needs to be making, or do we need to do a lot more in order to get there on the jobs front?
Well, not only do we need to do a lot more in that area, but that has to be part of a broader look at what we do. And to the governor's credit, he's done a lot in economic development, some things that I thought were wise and some not so wise, but he's done a lot. And the education piece is part of that. But I also just want to say, reflecting what Colin just said, universal pre-K, no question. Higher education at all levels for all people, also no question, but the higher education system has not been reformed and modernized in respect to how it's managed. And there's room for a lot of savings there. These are pretty inefficient operations. And the governor has made, for example, DEEP and some of the other agencies operate more. He say that the cliche is operate more like a business, and that has all kinds of negative implications. It just means doing more with less. And I don't get a sense that at the state university system they're doing more with less. That said, I'm not suggesting, hey, this should be cut. There's room in the middle for both ways of thinking.
Keith, from the way you look at it, are some of the budget priorities around education, are they fundable? I mean, do we have the money to do this?
That's a great point. This is where I'm going to point again how all life comes back to the state budget. But
which is a sad state of affairs.
It is. I'm not
you
proud of that.
You just depressed the heck out of me. Please.
But no, I mean, whether we're talking about universal pre-K or higher ed or, you know, business leaders will say we need high-speed commuter rail. Here's why: if you've got a post-election deficit, all that gets put on hold because The gubernatorial debate right now is already – you have on the Republican side Senator McKinney saying he wants to roll back the tax hike that Governor Malloy signed. So Governor Malloy responds by saying these rebates are just the first of more tax cuts I want to offer. After the election, somebody has to patch a budget hole, keep some promises regarding tax cuts. When do we get to all these things you guys have just been talking about?
Well, one of the other things that Republicans are talking about, and just before our break, Jackie, it's whether or not the K through 12 system in the state is actually working as has been currently constituted. The governor and his education commissioner, Stephen Pryor, backed off their plan on instituting the Common Core along with teacher evaluations under quite some pressure for teachers. Some Republicans, including some running for governor right now, are saying that Stephen Pryor should lose his job over this. Where do we stand with this, this balance between Governor Malloy and the teachers in the state?
It's a delicate balance of making sure that they're happy right now. The reforms are still moving forward. There was some flexibility built in. Common Core teachers or students will still be tested this spring. They will be tested next year. The question is whether or not they will be used in the evaluation next year. So the state last week was granted a waiver for those tests to not be used in the evaluations for this current school year. Next year remains a big question mark. That is a point of consternation for many, many teachers who say we're moving with a three-headed monster of having all these different reforms going at once. How can we sort of build a ship while it's moving, sort of. Sorry for that.
No, but that's almost Keith Vanneff-esque in the way that you put together that metaphor. We're talking with Jacqueline Rabe-Thomas, education reporter for the Connecticut Mirror. Keith Vanneff from the Connecticut Mirror, who covers the budget, a columnist for the Hartford Current, Dan Haar, and our own Colin McEnroe. We're going to take a break so that some of the folks can talk about our budget in the other room and how you can support WNPR. We'll be right back in the wheelhouse. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, it's been 50 years since LBJ declared a war on poverty. The federal poverty level today for a family of four, just over $23,500, meaning the single breadwinner working at the minimum wage couldn't even get close to being out of poverty. Are we anywhere near winning this war? We're going to talk about the war on poverty 50 years on, coming up on tomorrow's Where We Live. Today, it's The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. Colin McEnroe is here, as always. Colin, what's on your show this afternoon?
We're doing a show about living with MS. This is a disease. You know somebody who has MS. You may even know a bunch of people who have MS who've never told you they have MS. It's a kind of a mysterious disease to a lot of us, and we want to talk to people who actually have to get through their day with it.
It's an important and fascinating show. We'll be listening at 1 o'clock this afternoon on The Colin McEnroe Show. Also here with us in studio, Jacqueline Rabe-Thomas, who covers education for the Connecticut Mirror, Dan Haar, who's a columnist for the Hartford Current, and our budget guru, Keith Vanneff from the Connecticut Mirror. They're all here talking about a bunch of news this week. So let's go to you, Dan, and talk about something you wrote about this week. We passed all these new gun laws in Connecticut, and we were really anxiously going to see if anybody was going to, pay attention to these laws. What have you found? Are people obeying these new gun laws around military-style assault weapons?
Well, the registration number at 50,016, and that assumes that the 2,100 people who didn't write the form correctly get their forms in correctly. So 50,000 people registered – no, I'm sorry, 50,000 newly defined assault weapons.
So fewer people,
in.
Yes.
Right, and so that's a nice number, and it looks like a big number, and 50,000 weapons is a lot of firepower. But that falls short of what's out there by – we have no exact estimate. We have no really clear estimate. But by the best guess we have, there are at least 120,000 of these weapons in circulation in Connecticut and possibly as many as 400,000. This is based on both previous registration records, industry manufacturing records, sales records, and a lot of extrapolating. That means that if each person owns two, which is a good sort of typical average, then there are between 20,000 and 100 or more thousand potential felons in Connecticut. What do you do about it?
Yeah, so what do you do about it? I mean, have you gotten a chance to talk to any of these people?
Yes, I have.
Yeah.
The first thing that surprised me is I spoke with Scott Wilson at the Connecticut Citizens Defense League. He's hearing from a lot of people, not his 12,000 members, but a lot of people who didn't know about the law. Now, we in the news business guffaw about that and say, oh, how could anybody not know? But, you know, we're all plugged in this room, very highly plugged in, and all, I think your listeners are as well. But there are people who don't follow the news enough to have known that when they have an AR-15 sitting in the basement, they needed to register it. And that is, according to other people I've spoken with as well, there are a lot of people who simply didn't know. For that reason alone, the state should reopen the registration at least through 2014 with an ad campaign that says, hey, get your guns in. Come on, don't be a felon.
Well, and something that we've learned is when we do these tax amnesty days, I mean, people come back and they say, look, I don't want to pay the fine. I will pay my back taxes. That's actually helped us get money over the course of the last couple of years. Is this the sort of thing the state could do?
Yes, the tax amnesty was very successful in the fall. Therefore, you've proved Keith Faniff's dictum that all life goes through the state budget. I'm still getting my head around that one. But in that analogy, it works very well. The amnesty was 2 to 3 times bigger and more successful than people had thought it would be.
Colin, quickly on this, we spent the better part of a year talking about gun laws at the federal and at the state level. Is it surprising to you at all what Dan's finding?
No, it's not surprising. I think it's very important how this gets framed, though. You know, if it gets framed the way that Dan just did it, that's great. And I think you will see a bill. Craig Miner's already talking about bringing out a bill this session to kind of extend this thing somehow. And if it gets extended that way and hey, everybody maybe made some innocent mistakes, that's great, and I think it can be worked out. If it gets talked about as civil disobedience, which I'm starting to hear. First of all, please don't call this civil disobedience. It's not civil disobedience. When you drive 90 miles an hour on the highway, you're not engaging in an act of civil disobedience. You're just speeding. And this isn't civil disobedience. Civil disobedience is when you call attention to what you're doing. You invite the possibility of arrest. It's a disservice to all the people who were beaten, gassed, fire-hosed, and arrested for their civil disobedience to say that this is. But if we could have a civil conversation about this and say, okay, you didn't do so great the first time. You know, take 6 more months or whatever.
Keith?
Just one quick point, way that the two things might not be parallel. Believe me, when it comes to the tax amnesty program, the state had the advantage of the Connecticut CPAs were already poised to reach out to the people who owed the big money. There are a lot of small people who owed money who still, as Dan put it, are not plugged in, never knew. I'd be curious to know if when it comes to the guns, if the state can actually reach out through the associations who are connected to the gun owners. That's how you have the success like the tax amnesty program.
There's some of that is possible, but I think getting to what Colin said, from the people I've spoken with, the majority of those who didn't register did know about the law and did engage in what they think is an act of civil disobedience.
Well, they're wrong.
I would disagree about civil disobedience because in this case, these are people who believe that the registration law violates, rightly or wrongly, they believe that the registration law violates their constitutional rights. They're wrong about that, but they believe that. And more importantly, they believe that the registration will not reduce crime by one whit. They point out that there was in Connecticut from 1994 until the tragedy at Newtown one homicide by rifle.
The second piece of that isn't necessarily something that citizens can argue. I mean, at the end of the day, we don't argue laws based on statistics like that. To your point, though, Colin, I mean, Dan's making the case. It is, in a way, civil disobedience. People believe as though their rights are being infringed upon, and so therefore they're not complying.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of laws that I don't like, you know, and I have to follow them. If I don't like them, I can fight them in the legislature. I can fight them in court. There's a lot of things that I can do, or I can engage in a real act of civil disobedience where I present myself in a public situation and say, I am going to break this law because I think it's an unjust law. But just skulking around and not admitting you've got an assault rifle in your house, that's not civil disobedience.
We're talking today in the Wheelhouse about the news of the week, as always. And one more piece of news that we've been following here for months and months and months is sexual assault on college campuses. Jackie Reeb Thomas, there's a public hearing about legislation surrounding this yesterday. There have been a number of public hearings over the course of the last several months surrounding some of the events that happened months ago at UTown. There are ongoing cases surrounding this. What's new and what's this legislation?
So the legislation does several things. It would require the colleges, both public and private, throughout the state to include off-campus areas for students who are sexually assaulted. Right now, an incident has to occur on campus by law in order for the university or college to have to respond to it, providing different services and the availability of going forward with disciplinary procedures. What this law would do would bring both off-campus, and it would also require colleges, both public and private, to have response teams at each school. Now, many schools already have this. There was a survey that was done of 25 different schools. 20 of them already have it. This would make every school have that. And if it would also have them sign MOUs, memorandums of understanding, with local clinics and counselors to make sure that students have free access to those services. During the public hearing yesterday, several college officials said that they have some reservations. One thing is it conflicts with federal guidelines on this, and the federal government, at the urging of the White House recently, has been pushing forward with some changes and is expected to come up with some changes in the next 90 days for recommendations. And then also there's the concern of money, of how all these MOUs and these new assault response teams are going to actually play out. And for things like community colleges, you have a non-residential campus, and expecting them to have response teams for mental health services and all the above isn't necessarily very feasible. That would be creating completely new staff.
Importantly, what has changed at the University of Connecticut? The spotlight has been on UConn since the complaint, a federal complaint filed about the university's response to sexual assault on campus. How has UConn responded to all this, including how they responded at the Capitol?
So yesterday, they testified in support. They were the lone college system that actually supported the legislation in its entirety. They have come under fire recently because seven students have alleged that they did not handle their cases appropriately when they came forward. Another mother yesterday testified about her daughter and what situation her daughter, who attends UConn, and even after all of this came to light with the complaints this past fall, her daughter was date raped, and she said that not much has changed. The status quo remains at UConn. So there's sort of still conflicting opinions about how UConn is handling this. UConn has attempted to be very proactive and come out with some initiatives that they're planning on rolling out immediately. One of those is having a central hub so that there's no confusion of where students need to end up to move forward and have sort of a bill of rights for victims. So they are making some promises of changes.
Very quickly, Colin, is this something that you think at the end does have some sort of legislative remedy? We've been watching this go along the line as there have been a number of hearings up at the state capitol. Does the legislature get involved and change things about the sexual assault crisis on college campuses?
You know, reading the coverage today, I was asking myself this question, and I don't know the answer. I mean, the community colleges are saying this is an unfunded mandate in a lot of ways, and it's going to be very difficult for us to follow it. A lot of it, I think, it needs to be changed culturally by the colleges, not necessarily through legislation. It's a really complicated problem, including just the fact of some sexual assaults happen off campus. They may involve two members of the student community, but if they happen off campus, it becomes a different kind of police matter in that situation. The mother who testified yesterday was talking about that kind of case. There are still hearings on campus, but then you're also dealing with the state police. That's a slightly different animal than the assault that happens on campus. This all needs to be talked out probably first within the university.
We're going to move on because the last thing we want to talk about today is something a lot of us are watching and talking about right now. It's the Olympics, and we want to bring in Gretchen Silverman, who won a gold medal with the U.S. women's hockey team in the 1998 Winter Olympics. She's been watching closely this game that's been going on this morning. I'm going to give a spoiler alert right now. Spoiler alert. Right now, Canada is winning a game between the U.S. and Canada 3-2, but I don't believe that it's over yet. Gretchen, welcome to our program.
Good morning.
So tell us about the growth in women's hockey. Ever since you won this gold medal, it seems to be more and more popular all the time. Tell us the feeling as you see more and more people getting involved in your sport.
Oh, it's great. You know, after 1998, you know, we were in Japan, and we didn't really realize all the attention that we were getting back home until we arrived back home victorious, and there were lots of hometown celebrations and lots of publicity. And so for the very first time, women's hockey really came to the forefront of American consciousness, and it's been exciting. There's been an explosion of women and girls involved in the sport now from very young ages, and so the whole level of play has really risen since then.
And the level of play in the U.S. and Canada certainly has risen. This game today, from what I understand now, Canada has won this game 3-2. Do you expect that the U.S. and Canada will be playing again in the gold medal game?
I would expect that, absolutely. They are two of the best teams in the world. It's obvious why. They spend a lot of time training, and the countries take the sport very seriously. I think they're leading the way for a lot of other countries who still need to catch up. But I think other countries are definitely trying to put the money and the effort into developing their programs as well. They're just not quite there yet.
We've seen this a lot in women's college basketball. There's this stratification between the teams like UConn that win all the time and other programs that can't seem to get up and running. Is that a problem in some ways for the sport, that there are some countries that are so strong in women's hockey and some that just haven't gotten there yet?
Yeah, you know, I think that hockey is one of those sports that's certainly financially constricting for some people, and so there's not a lot of opportunity for some young kids in other countries to necessarily get started at a young age. So a lot of countries are a little bit behind the eight ball when it comes to developing their players. They have to start with kids who are a little bit older. So, you know, they're definitely at a disadvantage, and I think that there's some effort, you know, being put towards those developments of programs, but they're definitely still struggling to try to catch up.
So now you're a hockey coach and a teacher at the Taft School. Tell us about young women who want to get involved in hockey. I mean, is it something that more people want to get involved in all the time? What are the parents and the students saying to you about this sport?
Yeah, you know, it's an exciting time for girls in hockey. There's tons of college programs that didn't exist back when I was going to college. You know, colleges, it was primarily on the East Coast. It was the Ivy League and the ECAC teams. There were, you know, much more limited opportunities. And now the sky's the limit. You know, we have several girls-only programs in the state of Connecticut alone that are developing young players. And, you know, the prep school program is certainly strong and vibrant. We're getting kids from other countries coming over to attend prep school and college here to try to develop, you know, those players from abroad. So I think that it's a great opportunity for girls to be involved in the sport. You know, the Olympics now being a reality for girls to look to as a goal. I think it's really exciting. I think there's plenty of opportunity for kids to get involved. And, you know, most of the girls when I was growing up played all boys hockey because that was the only option.
That's right.
There's certainly plenty of other opportunities now for girls to get involved if they're not comfortable joining a boys' team, to get involved with a girls' program.
And maybe even end up at someday in the Olympics, like Gretchen Silverman, who won a gold medal with the U.S. women's hockey team back in 1998. We'll be watching the Olympics along with you, Gretchen. Thanks so much.
Great. My pleasure.
Before we go on the wheelhouse, I just want to say thanks to all of our panelists. Colin McEnroe, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. What's your favorite winter sport, Colin?
Oh, luge, absolutely.
Luge, absolutely. Thank you very much. Jackie Rabe Thomas from the Connecticut Mirror. What's your favorite winter sport?
Football.
Football.
Is that all considered
they
winter?
Don't they don't play that in the Olympics, but you still like football. Dan, thank you very much, Jackie. Dan Haar from the Hartford Current. Favorite Olympic sport, I should be clear. Go ahead.
All Olympics?
All
winter. Let's do Winter Olympics.
Winter
the 30K cross-country race was an unbelievable race. Fabulous.
That's a pretty good race. And Keith Fanta from the Connecticut Mirror, how about you?
Speed skating.
Speed skating is very good. I love to watch ski jumping. You can watch the Olympics along with us. Maybe we'll have some more Olympics coverage next week on The Wheelhouse. Thank you so much for joining us. Now some of my colleagues are going to tell you how you can get involved in WNPR in supporting the programming that we have here. Thanks.